Hello, everybody. My name is Atul Arya. Welcome to CERAWeek Conversations by IHS Markit. This is the inaugural edition of these conversations. We will be holding them over the next weeks and months. And these conversations will include conversations with IHS Markit experts, with industry leaders, as well as thought leaders. For the very first inaugural conversation, which will be on oil markets, I'm very pleased to have Dr. Dan Yergin, who is Vice Chairman of IHS Markit, Chairman of CERAWeek, and a Pulitzer Prize winning author. And the most important thing for all of you to know is that Dan is very soon coming out with his new book, very timely given where we are. It's entitled The New Map, Energy, Climate, and Clash of Nations. So look out for that on Amazon and in your bookstores sometime later in the summer. And in addition to Dan, we also have Jim Burkhardt. Jim is the Vice President in our oil markets team. Jim oversees the global oil markets research with analysts around the world. In addition to that, Jim leads the work on mobility and energy futures and the close link between the future of oil and future of mobility. So great to have both Dan and Jim for this inaugural CERAWeek conversation. And the topic of the conversation is the future of oil markets. So let's get into it. We know the context for why we are starting with oil markets. The world is upside down because of COVID-19 coronavirus outbreak, and also because of the challenges within the oil market, which were taking place before COVID-19 took place. So Dan, I want to start with you. So tell us, where are we now? What's happening?
What's happened is that we have an oil market war going on, a battle for market share in the midst of this gigantic economic and health crisis that's enveloping much of the world. It started with a disagreement between Russia and Saudi Arabia about what to do in terms of cutting production or not cutting production. But the result has been that the spigots are being opened up and more oil is flooding into a market that is already very oversupplied because of the drop in demand.
Yeah, and then, you know, when this started, it was more of a supply issue, but as you point out, it has become a demand issue now, isn't it?
Well, we've seen, yes, in the first quarter, we were seeing demand coming down sharply in China because of the shutdown of China. And at that point, we thought in the first quarter, demand would be 4 million barrels a day, lower than it had been a year ago. Now, as we look at what's happened in the US and Europe, we say more like 6 million barrels a day in the first quarter. And when we get into the second quarter, we're looking at something, I know Jim will talk about this more, but 10 to 15 million barrels a day. So this is unprecedented.
Yeah, that's right. So let me ask Jim. So Jim, you've been looking at the whole issue of demand as to how quickly the oil demand has dropped. So could you share as to what you're seeing now and what do you see, you know, going into the future for the rest of this year and beyond?
Yes, thanks, Atul. As Dan mentioned, this is a demand shock, a negative demand shock, and it really almost emerged overnight, beginning in late January, early February in China, and it's since deteriorated. And we have a chart here to illustrate the depth of the demand decline we've seen in this quarter and what we expect in the second quarter. So as Dan mentioned, down 6 million barrels per day from a year earlier in the first quarter of this year. Our estimate is down about 14 million barrels per day in the second quarter. And in terms of a historical context, the last time we had declines like this is never happened before. The deepest drop in quarterly demand in history before now was in the first quarter of 2009, when demand fell about 2.9 million barrels per day during the financial crisis. So the freezing of large parts of China's economy in February, the impact of the COVID-19 spread and lockdowns in Europe and the United States have halted much of a lot of economic and transportation activity. And you see that reflected in demand. For example, in April, we're anticipating that U.S. gasoline demand, which typically is around 9-10 million barrels per day, is going to be about half, if not even a little bit below. So that's the type of the magnitude of the decline we're seeing. Our outlook does assume that the COVID-19 in our base case, that the peak outside of China takes place in the second quarter, and then there's a gradual recovery. It will take time, but demand will grow again, and we expect that to be the case in 2022. But for now, as we'll see in the next slide, this demand decline is leading to an enormous supply surplus. So the supply surplus is simply production less demand. And this chart shows the history of surplus or deficits in the oil market. And going back to 2000 up till now, they've been in the ballpark of 100 million, 200 million. We had a peak of a 320 million barrel surplus over 6 months in 2015. But now, when you look at the severe drop in demand and the trajectory that oil production is still on, we're looking at a massive surplus for the first half of this year that will be could be about 1.8 billion barrels, far higher than anything we've ever seen in history. But here's the real problem, and we're seeing this unfold right now, the lack of storage capacity relative to the surplus. The surplus cannot exceed the world's ability to store oil. We estimate that global storage capacity for crude oil, at most, the available storage right now is about 1.6 billion barrels. So the surplus cannot exceed that number, which means we're likely to see lower production, perhaps some forced shut-in production for a time, this especially as we get to the second quarter. I'll end up on our story about storage. That's our next slide here. So the key question right now in the market is, where can it be stored? And storage capacity is not uniform around the world. There's a lot of capacity in the United States. China has a fair amount. Russia, relative to the size of its oil production, does not have a lot. And when we look at places where production could be reduced or even shut in, it's not so much the break-even price that is going to determine that. It's going to be the availability of storage. And storage is at a premium now, and it will be as long as demand continues to fall in March and April and into May.
So Jim, before I go back to Dan, a quick question. You said up to 1.6 billion barrels on this slide, unused capacity. Can all of it be used? Because you need to be in the right place to store oil, isn't it?
That's right. That's one of the problems that we're going to face, Atul, is not every place that can store oil is available to whoever wants to use it. There's some companies have dedicated storage. And if you're producing oil in one part of the world and there's no storage there, it may not really matter if there happens to be an empty tank in, say, South Africa. So finding storage is going to be quite a challenge. And there'll be some localized issues where we could see the system seize up for a bit.
Yeah. So let's move back to Dan here. So Dan, how do you see this will impact, first starting with North America shale? Because, you know, since the last downturn, shale has really grown in supply significantly. What do you see the outlook for that?
I thought it was really quite extraordinary that since the original OPEC, non-OPEC deal was made in 2016, U.S. oil production grew by almost 60%. So February of this year, U.S. output reached 13.1 million barrels a day, which is the highest level it ever had. It was almost 2 million barrels a day more than Russia was producing at the time, 3.5 million more than Saudi Arabia was producing at the time. But shale needs continual investment, and what we're seeing now is prices come down so dramatically, 60% since the beginning of the year. Budgets are being cut, activity is going down rapidly, people are trying to conserve cash, some are trying to survive. So it's going to be a rough period for those companies in U.S. shale. And we think that a year, you know, 2021, we could see U.S. production 2 to 3 million barrels a day lower than it is today as people adjust to this price regime and also the lack of access to capital.
Yeah. So Dan, one of the things which has been out there is that there needs to be a deal of some sorts. So I'll ask the question to both you and Jim, starting with you, a deal between or among U.S., Russia, and OPEC. or Saudi Arabia specifically, feasible, and how big an impact will it have?
You're talking about a deal among the big three who really dominate the world oil industry today.
Right.
I think we've seen recently a real step up of concern from Washington, both not only from the executive branch, but very strongly from the from Congress. 13 Republican senators signed a pretty strong letter. So I think there's not much chance for dialogue with Russia, given where the U.S. and Russia are today on energy issues and sanctions and so forth. So the dialogue will be, I think, with Saudi Arabia and maybe through some larger framework that provides a way to talk about production to try and end an all-out price war, market share war, and maybe doing that through the framework of the G20. And I think already discussions have begun in that direction. But no timing. This could be, you know, at this point, resolving the market share battle would only address maybe 40% of the oversupply, but that would still be very significant. And I think it would be psychologically significant for the markets. It could be ended with a phone call between the two principals. But it could also take longer, and there are a lot of other entrenched positions. But what does make it very difficult is that you have this occurring, not in, you know, in previous times when it was a time of economic growth, but in what may be turn out to be the most serious economic crisis since the Second World War.
Yeah, that's right. So therein lies the challenge. So Jim, you know, back in February, end of February 28th, when the OPEC Plus talks broke down, the feeling was this was a really a supply issue, too much supply. And now, as you put all the slides back, that it was all a demand. It's now a big demand issue. So how do you see the market balancing, you know, and how long will it take?
The answer to that, Atul, I think, depends whether there's renewed cooperation between oil superpowers or if economic pain is ultimately the way that rebalances the oil market. If you assume no change in production policy by any major producer right now, the surplus is going to keep downward pressure on prices for some time. It's going to be a very difficult second quarter, perhaps beyond that as well. We'll have an inventory overhang that will dampen the upward pressure on prices that could materialize in the second half of the year. One way or another, there will be a rebalancing. It's just a question of whether that's done through international dialogue or through the economic pain that the supply overhang is going to inflict.
Yeah, we're already seeing production being shut in. And when Jim talks about through economic pain, the way that manifests itself is people shutting in production, which has happened before.
Yeah, that's where I was going to go, as to where do you see, both of you see, production shutting in. You know, we have always felt that U.S. shale is very much responsive, right? It can be shut in, you know, faster than pretty much anywhere else. But how do you see the situation now? Let me start with you, Dan.
There's already shut in production in the North Sea. We can see it in Africa. So it's not going to just be limited by any means, I think, to U.S. shale. But of course, what's different about U.S. shale, it's not only a question of shutting in. It's also a question of not investing in new production to renew the production. So it's a little different calculus from other parts of the world.
Yeah. Jim?
There's really no place to hide. And of course, there'll be a lot of focus on what happens in the U.S. and the reaction to U.S. The reaction of U.S. producers will be pivotal in the story that's unfolding. But if you look at West Africa, Dan mentioned the North Sea, Russia, Saudi sales into East Asia. East Asia is still contracting. There's really no place to hide right now.
So how are the companies then dealing with this? You know, this is kind of, they came out of the 15-16 downturn feeling good. As you said, production went up 60%, but here comes another downturn. What are the strategies companies using to respond?
The big thing, and we've seen it, is that people are really cutting their budgets that they announced maybe just a month or two ago for 2020. And I think the projects that are already underway will continue, or if they're fairly far along, new projects will be put on hold. I think people will be looking to be more efficient in their operations. Clearly, the impact of this will fall on people. I think companies will probably speed up divestitures by large companies. And I think the other thing, though, all companies have to be preoccupied with operations and how do you maintain continuity of operations when, unbeknownst to anyone, somebody comes down sick and then the people around them have to be quarantined. And how do you maintain operations when air flights are being canceled? You can't fly into other countries. So I think as a global industry, as one of the most global, maybe the most global industry in the world, I think the oil and gas industry faces additional challenges that come from the closing of borders.
Yeah, and do you see, besides the cutback in investments, other actions such as, dividend payment, how safe is that? What's your sense?
Well, I mean, obviously the companies will decide themselves, but I think the dividend payment for the large companies is pretty sacrosanct. That's part of its social contract with investors. So I think great effort will be made to protect dividend. Of course, with stock prices way down, dividends now as a percentage are quite large and competitive. But it's not because the times are good, but because the times are bad.
Yeah, Jim, I want to come back to Saudi Arabia and Russia because, they had both Saudi Arabia in particular announced significant increase in production, even while there is this massive drop in demand. Are you still seeing that? What are we seeing from Saudi Arabia? And are we seeing that from Russia as well?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, Saudi Arabia has reaffirmed a couple times their plan to supply the market with up to 12.3 million barrels per day in April. It seems so far that that may continue into May. And back in February, Saudi Arabia was producing about 9.7 million barrels per day. The Russian energy minister, Minister Novak, has said Russia could increase production 300,000 to 500,000 barrels per day. So obviously, this is primarily a demand collapse story, but this additional supply we're seeing is making the situation even more challenging.
Yeah, and then maybe to end, let's look back at history, because this kind of situation has, maybe not to this extreme, as both of you have said, but it has happened before. Could you say a little bit from your historical, being a historian, your perspective on the past and how things change, evolved after such a downturn?
Well, I think that, as I say, what we're seeing now is unprecedented, but there are analogies. And the analogies are 1998, 1986, and the 1930s. And if we take 1998 as an example, what happened was that the producers increased production thinking that Asia was going to continue its wonderful economic miracle, and instead it was going into the Asian financial crisis. So the market quickly became oversupplied. You ran out of storage, just the way Jim has described it, not in these volumes, but you ran out, and prices fell to $10 a barrel or lower. I think 1986, you saw a similar phenomenon, that the buildup of storage, running out of storage, becomes a regulator on the industry. And of course, the great story, the dramatic story that I have in the prize is the 1930s in Texas, when you had the discovery of this huge amount of oil in East Texas flooded into the market. And it's said that the oil was selling at 10 cents a barrel. And if you pulled into a gas station, they gave you a free chicken as a premium. People were so desperate to move the supply. Of course, that was a very different era. So that analogy is very dramatic. But I think the more recent ones are the ones that give us some guidance, although not on the scale we're now seeing.
Yeah. So Jim, as you look forward now into the next coming weeks, what are the things you are going to be keeping an eye on and working on as well in your research?
Well, storage is key. Storage sometimes is kind of a ignored segment of oil market analysis, but that's really front and center. Where is oil flowing? Are there stranded cargoes? What's happening with floating storage? Tracking onshore storage. That's really where the action is now, to try and understand when will we hit that limit on storage, or how close are we getting to that limit.
Mm-hmm. And then last word from you, what would you advise our listeners and people watching this as to what should they be keeping an eye on?
Well, I think obviously really key question is when does the world economy come back? When does it open up for business again? And that will be determined by how long the quarantines remain, how long businesses are shuttered, how long factories aren't operating, how long people aren't driving. And is that a question of 2 months or is it longer than that? But that will be, you know, what will really determine. And then what we need to see is how the players in this industry respond to this situation and respond to this very great uncertainty.
Yeah. So with that sobering statement, thank you, Dan, and thank you, Jim. Thank you, everybody, for listening and watching to our inaugural CERAWeek conversation. There'll be many more of this to come, and so please join us again. And until then, thank you and goodbye.